Rashid. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for, again, accommodating the last-minute announcement on timing of these shiurim. So I don't yet know exactly what time we'll do next week. Probably also 7 o'clock, but I'm not sure. Anyone who's interested in, they just put together a WhatsApp group so that we can inform people who come to these shiurim and then the other shiurim that I give, you know, when they're going to be given, other than my daily Yerdei shiur, but, you know, all the other, the Temin Halachas and things like that. So if you're interested in joining that, I don't know what you do. What do you if you're joining that? Henry, what do we do? Contact Henry Olinsky? I don't know. I guess. Or you could text me and I'll let you know how to... someone will tell me how to tell you how to do that. Okay, so two shilas for tonight, as always. Shila number one, I got a call from a local Rav who told me that there is a young lady in his shul who is a wonderful young woman, a very frum and nice and sweet girl from a great family, a very attractive young lady, and she has a nervous habit, though, that when she's bored or nervous or whatever, she starts yanking out hairs from her eyebrows. That's her nervous habit that she has. So now she's in the Parsha of Shiduchim, and she has these, like, bald spots in her eyebrows. So she's a little self-conscious about these bald spots in her eyebrows, and she wants to know if she could do a procedure called microblading. Microblading is a kind of a semi-permanent makeup that they put on. That's what they call it. They call it semi-permanent makeup. What it really means is a semi-temporary tattoo, meaning it cuts under the skin a little bit and deposits some ink under the skin, and it lasts for anywhere between 1 and 3 years. And that way, she won't be self-conscious about her eyebrows because it will be all filled in through the microblading procedure. It's not the first time I've been asked the shayla, but I have a practice that whenever a shayla is asked more than once in a week, and it's not a usual shayla, I always use that for the rabbi's desk. So the second I got another rav called me up this week with not exactly the same shayla, but a similar shayla. Not a girl who was starting to date, but a woman who was asking a Hilchas Nida shayla. She was going to the mikvah, and she wanted to know if she does this procedure, is this going to be a chatzitza going to the mikvah? And this woman said she's not going to do microblading, she's going to do powder brows, which is another way to fill in, and apparently gives a more fuller look than the microblading look. But when you Google it, you'll find that powder brows are really not all that different from microblading in that it cuts under the skin and deposits ink under the skin in order to make it look like a fuller eyebrow. I think the powder brows leave a little mamashos also above the skin, so it really gives a more fuller kind of look, and that's the advantage of the powder brows over the microblading. So that is shayla number one. Shayla number two that came up, it's almost hard to believe that this shayla exists, but it does. Someone asked me, he told me that it's a true shayla, that it's a friend of his. He said that an old friend of his had passed away. And he said that his friend, the person that told me this is a young person. He's in his 40s, I would say. And he said that that his friend, who I imagine is around his age, had passed away. And he said that his friend was a very disturbed person. He was a very emotionally disturbed person throughout his lifetime. He had many problems, most likely resulting from an accident that he had suffered as a child. He had suffered some sort of trauma or head injury as a child, and he never fully recovered and never really was able to fully socially integrate as an adult. He was married at some point, but then didn't have any children, and ultimately got divorced. And throughout his entire life, he had a complete lack of concern for money. Not only for his own money, for other people's money. So, you know, sometimes you say someone has no concern about money and it sounds like a compliment. And sometimes it's very nice. He gives out all of his money, and he did. He would, if he'd make money, he would, give it to the next beggar on the street, whatever money you paid him. But if you had money and it was out and it was available and it was there for the taking, he would take that too. He would, without without any hesitation, he would steal other people's money. This fellow told me that one time he got a call from his friend. He said he got arrested, and he said, "What did you do? Why did you get arrested?" He said, "Well, you know, I'm a carpenter by trade, and the person I was working for gave me his credit card to buy materials that I need for the job. So I also bought whatever tools I need and everything else that he used the credit card to buy, and just like with no hesitation about like why that might be wrong or why he shouldn't be doing that." So Nebuch, this is the kind of the habit that he developed, or just a lack of understanding of how money works. It almost reminds you of Eino Osek Bi Yeshuvo Shalolam. You know, like Chazal say that a gambler is Eino Osek Bi Yeshuvo Shalolam, someone who just doesn't understand what it means, what money means. In addition to that, maybe equally disturbingly or more disturbing, I don't know what's more disturbing or not, he also developed a habit of collecting, for lack of a better term, adult memorabilia. He was in possession of materials that I didn't even know that there are collectors of such things, but he had like adult films or magazines that were like first edition that you can apparently, don't Google it, but apparently if you go on, eBay, it can command hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, some of this stuff that he was in possession of. His siblings, his parents are all nice, from people. And now this fellow died, and this is the legacy that that he left. So here were their shailas. First of all, they know that he owes money to other people. This fellow died in debt. He definitely owed money to other people. He didn't have any money, but he had these valuable collection of adult memorabilia. They don't want to deal with this. They want to throw it all in the garbage and forget that it ever existed. However, it has value, and he owed money to other people. So they wanted to know, are they permitted to throw it out, or are they obligated to go sell it on eBay so that they can pay back the people that he owed money to, who are out this money? So that is shaila number one. Shaila number two that they had is that the fellow's brother also works as a carpenter, and he can use some new equipment. He doesn't have all the fanciest tools, because he doesn't take the people's credit cards and go buy whatever he needs. So, but he knows that all of his brother's stuff is at least becheskas suffix stolen. So he doesn't know. Is he allowed to take the Yerusha, so to speak, from his brother of all of his tools, knowing that there's a reasonable possibility that it's stolen? So that is shaila number two. Wow, okay, so it looks like the voting has already come in.
What happened to the young lady? Wasn't that one?
That was one, yeah.
And then this is a two-part shaila number
This
two?
Is a two-part shaila, yes.
So
shaila number one is the young lady who is dating and wants to know if she can get microbladed eyebrows. Shaila number two is about this Nebuch, this disturbed fellow who passed away, and the family has this complicated legacy to deal with, and some halachic issues related to that complicated legacy, namely whether they're obligated to sell his collection to pay back his debts, and whether the brother is allowed to take his tools that he used in his carpentry business. So those.
I can't beat the rogue, but I'd love to know the bottom line for this young lady.
For the young lady. Okay. Maybe we'll have to give a 10-minute halacha shir on that. Oh, we're out of 10-minute halacha. Did I announce that we're not doing? I could announce one at any time, now that we have that WhatsApp group. I could just say, you know, at like 2 in the morning. Okay, now everyone, we'll see who shows up.
Shaila number two, how do we classify Divrei Yisurim?
Divrei, what do you mean?
The items that someone leaves over.
Right, so he has Dvarim Asurim, right? These are things that are definitely usher to have. Which is part of the question. If you put it on eBay, who's going to buy it? So let's assume rove of the people that are in such a market are non-Jews. So that's, I think, fair to assume that. You don't have to be a Berdichever to assume that, right? That rove of the people in the market for such things are non-Jews. Rove of the people in the world are non-Jews. And one would hope that that Jewish people, al pi rove, are not involved in such things. But certainly rove of the people that would be in the market to buy such things are non-Jews. So is it necessarily violating lifnei iver? Let's say, is it dvar masurim for them? Is it a davar aser for a non-Jew to buy such things, or is it only a davar aser for a Jew? So, I mean, is there an issur to get hana from these things by selling them? They're not even getting hana. You're just doing it to pay off the guy's debts. The family is probably, does the family have any responsibility to worry about paying off his debts, right? So these are the complicated issues that they're dealing with. So it looks like it was an almost unanimous decision to go with Shaila number two. We'll have to go back to the microblading at some other time. I guess spoiler alert on the microblading, just to give you just to give you the bottom line. You said you wanted to know the bottom line, is that Rav Sabalovsky was Makel. I was sitting next to Rav Sabalovsky at a chasna the other night, and he pulled out a sefer. I said, wait, before you start learning, let me ask you a shayla. So I asked him the shayla. He told me that Rabbi Willig quotes Yerushalmi that identifies shiduchim for the ability of a woman to find a shidduch as karov lepikuach nefesh, and he says that's the way you have to view it, not that it's mamish pikuach nefesh, but that it should be taken very, very seriously, such a tzorech for shiduchim, and if she doesn't feel good about herself with shiduchim, then it would be a kavod abrios, it would rise to the level of kavod abrios, and the microblading is only in issur drabanan, and b'makom kavod abrios, where she's allowed to violate the drabanan. It's more complicated than that. What makes it only in issur drabanan? Mehechi tesi, it's only in issur drabanan. What qualifies as kavod abrios? And if are there any other sniffin makel? So it is a complicated topic, but not for right now. I guess because everyone voted for the other topic, so let's go with the other topic, with the topic of this fellow's complicated legacy, Nebuch. So. Okay, let's first discuss the stolen property. I think that might be the simpler of the two topics to tackle. So in terms of dealing with stolen property in general, meaning am I allowed to buy stolen property? Am I allowed to take stolen property in a legitimate way? Someone is selling something and I have reason to be choshesh that which he is selling may in fact be stolen. So am I allowed to have any asek in such property? So there is a halacha that the Gemara tells us in Baba Kama and Daf Kuf Yud Chesam Beis, going over to Daf Kuf Yud Chesam Aleph, and also in Kiddushin on Daf Nun Vavam Beis, and it's quoted in the Rambam in the fifth parak of Hilchas Keneva, and in the Shulchan Aruch and Chashin Mishpat, Simin Shin Nun Vav, where the Shulchan Aruch writes, we'll just quote from the Shulchan Aruch, we'll go cut straight to the chase over here, Shulchan Aruch writes, Asur liknos me'aganav ha'chefetz shaganav, that you're not allowed to buy from a ganav an object that he had stolen. Va'avon gadolu, it's a great avera. Shari machzik yidei over avera, because when you purchase a stolen object from a ganav, you are encouraging over avera. V'gorim lo liknov gnevos acheros, and you're giving him the ability to continue his life of stealing. You're causing him to steal more. Shem lo yimtzo lokeach in a ganav, because if you wouldn't find someone to buy it from him, then he wouldn't be gonev, then he wouldn't steal. And the Rama writes, V'chein asur l'seyer l'ganav b'shum davar k'dei she'ignav. Not only to buy the items that he steals, you're not allowed to help him with anything that will enable him to steal. Sefer Mi'iras Einayim on the side of the page in the Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat and Sivkat and Aleph explains or points out that the Gemara has an expression, a mashal, da amri inchi lo achbra ganav ela chora ganav, that it's not the mouse that steals, it is the hole that the mouse hides his stolen objects that really steals. Meaning, if the mouse had nowhere to put that which he stole, then he wouldn't steal. So it's not the achbar, it's not the rat that's the thief, it's the hole that enables him to put stuff away that is the thief on a certain level that we view as the thief. So that is the halacha. Now, does any of that apply to us? Well, certainly you're not allowed to buy stolen goods, but in our case, the fellow was not buying anything. He was yarshening stolen goods. And what's the issue? You're not allowed to buy stolen goods because you're giving encouragement to the ganav to steal more. Over here, you're not giving encouragement to anybody to steal more. First of all, you're not going out of your way to buy it. The guy's already, the brother's already, unfortunately, no longer in this world, and it's there. It's just there for the taking. It's a Yerusha. He has no Yarshim. The brother's the closest Yorish, or the father's the closest Yorish, but the father has no need for it, so the brother's the closest Yorish. So he's going to receive it automatically. He's not going out of his way to buy it. And what's the little concern? That he's going to go and he's going to steal again? Unfortunately, he's not able to go and steal again. The Rivash writes in a tshuva in Simon Kuf Ches that the Isser to aid a ganav is even if you're not sure if the item is stolen, but there's raglayim ledavar, that the item is stolen. What does it mean, raglayim ledavar? The person sells you an item that you know is supposed to cost $1,000, and he's selling it to you for $150. So it's raglayim ledavar. There's no way that he'd be able to sell it to you at that price if he legitimately got it. So, so if the price is very low for no apparent reason, or the seller is very clear that he's trying to get rid of the item as quickly as he possibly can, that would constitute raglayim ledavar, and you shouldn't buy it in that case either. And then the Shulchan Aruch quotes this as well. Now in the Shulchan Aruch, in Chosh Mishmas and Shin Nun Gimel, he says that if you were to buy a stolen object from somebody, so what's the halacha? Meaning, do you have to give it back? Meaning, let's say the brother takes these items. Does he have to? And let's say he somehow were able to find out who it was stolen from. Does he even have an obligation to pay it back to the person it was stolen from? Meaning, if I bought something and I didn't know that it was stolen, you're not allowed to buy something that you know is stolen. Let's say I bought something and I didn't know that it was stolen. Do I have to give it back to the person that it was stolen from when I do find out that it was stolen? Let's say during Shiva, someone comes in and says, oh, by the way, those tools were stolen off my credit card. He bought those tools. They were stolen from me. He was on a job together with me, and he took those tools. Do you have to pay it back? So the halacha is that once there's yeyush v'shina rishus, if the original owner gave up hope of ever getting it back, and then it would subsequently change hands, the halacha is that with yeyush and shina rishus, your kona, which means, and that Shulchan Aruch paskens this in Simon Shin Nun Gimel, that with Yeush and Shina Rishus, the person is kona. So presumably, if this fellow died with all these stolen items, presumably the original owner had Yeush. Now there's Shina Rishus because it's transferring over to his brother, and therefore he is kona. Now, if there's not yet Shina Rishus, if there's not yet Yeush, rather, at the time of the Shina Rishus, I buy the item, and then the original owner is Miyayesh, then it's not kona. Then, according to the strict halacha, I have to return the item, and I don't get compensated for it. I have to just give it back, even though I laid out money for it. But I have to give it back because I was never kona it. If he was only miyayish after I already took possession of it, that is the halacha me'ikar adin. However, Chazal realized that that could really stifle the market in a significant way. Meaning, can you imagine if every time I bought something and I paid good money for it, I have in the back of my mind that I might have to return it and not get my money back? I might have to, because I have to worry about the person that I'm buying from. He seems like an honest guy, seems like an Erlicha guy, but a lot of people seem like Erlicha guys and aren't really such Erlicha guys. I know a person that is mamish, a terrible, terrible person. I mean, without any hesitation, I can say that this person is a completely dishonest person, pretends to be a tzaddik, and I know that he's a terribly dishonest person, and all he looks to do is create machlokas and line his own pockets. I happen to know this about the person. I was talking to a prominent Rosh Yeshiva recently, and the prominent Rosh Yeshiva says he's an Erlucha Tamil Chacham. You want Tamil Chacham? Yes, he happens to be very knowledgeable. Erluch, the exact opposite of an Erlucha Tamil Chacham. He's a very knowledgeable person, but it's not Erluch, the exact opposite of Erluch. So I buy something from somebody who seems like an Erlucha Tamil Chacham. A very Chashuv Rosh Yeshiva thinks he's an Erlucha Tamil Chacham, but I buy something, and now I have to to worry that maybe he stole the item and now I'm going to have to give it back without any money? So Chazal say, if I'm not protected in any way, when I buy items, it's going to really stifle the market in a significant way. So since that's going to ruin the ability for the market to work properly, so there's what's called the Takanas HaShuk. And the Takanas HaShuk tells me that if the buyer didn't know at the time of the purchase that that which he got was stolen, he's allowed to demand that the original owner pays him back the amount that he paid for the item before returning the item. He doesn't have to return it until the original owner is willing to pay him. He doesn't, not at a profit, but at least the amount that he paid for it. If you know that the seller is a thief, then according to the Shulchan Aruch, the Takanas HaShuk does not apply. According to the Shulchan Aruch, you do not get to demand that that you get paid back. Although according to the Ramah, it would even apply then. Even if I knew he was a thief and I bought it from him, as long as I didn't know that this item was stolen, as long as I didn't know that this particular thing that I am getting was stolen, even if I knew that the guy was a ganav, Takanas HaShuk applies, says the Ramah. The Ramah points out, though, that if the Dina de Malchusa is such that you have to return stolen goods to the owner, even if the Yeyusha happened before the sale, meaning we know that the din in the Torah is that if the Yeyusha happens before the sale, I don't have to return the goods at all. But if the Dina de Malchusa is that I do, then the Halacha would also require that which the Dina de Malchusa requires, and you'd have to return it. So says the Ramah in Shin Nun Gimel. However, the Ktsos points out over there that that's only Lifnim Mishuras Adin. That idea that you have to follow the Dina de Malchusa against the Dina Torah, when we're dealing with two Jews and about returning something back to a Jewish person who the item was stolen from, that is only Lifnim Mishuras Adin. Me'ikra Adin, two Jews are not bound by Dina de Malchusa. Dina de Malchusa is between a Jew and a non-Jew, but if it's between two Jews, they have to follow the and it's monetary law, they follow the laws of the Choshen Mishpat. They should not follow the laws of the Din of Malchusa, but as a Lefnim Mishuras Adin, you would have to return it. But only Lefnim Mishuras Adin, and therefore, since it's only Lefnim Mishuras Adin, it's a minuk tov yashar or whatever, but it's not something you would have to do if you can't really afford to do it. The Shulchan Aruch strongly implies that anything that's based on Din Malchusa, that if the Din Malchusa would dictate that you have to return it, the Shulchan Aruch strongly implies that means without any compensation. Meaning even if the Din Malchusa say you have to return it without compensation, after Yeyush Vashini Rishus, then you'd have to do even that, to return it without compensation after Yeyush Vashinoi Rishus. But again, I think all of that lichora does not apply in our case, because in our case there is no buying. He didn't. He doesn't know who the person who was stolen. He doesn't know that the items were stolen. It's a suffix in the first place whether the items were stolen. He doesn't know even if it were stolen who it was stolen from. It's possible someone will come in and claim that it was stolen from them, but you don't know that to be the case. You don't know that to be true, and no one has come and claimed it to this point. He just feels uneasy about the fact that it's likely that it was stolen, but considering that there's Yeyush and there's Shinoi Rishus, it doesn't seem that he should have any hesitation about being able to use these items after Yeyush and Shinoi Rishus. Would I tell him to buy them off of his brother if his brother were still alive? No, certainly not. You wouldn't recommend buying something from a known ganav. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says, that if you know that someone is a ganav, you shouldn't buy from him, even if you don't know that these items were stolen. So that's as far as the brother using the tools is concerned. What about selling this man's collection on eBay in order to pay back the debts? So two things you have to think about over here. First thing you have to think about is it even permissible to sell it on eBay? Meaning, aren't you being machshil other people in these isurim of looking at inappropriate materials? Now, one could I'd argue, whoever is going to be looking at these inappropriate materials, these collector edition inappropriate materials, has free access to equally inappropriate and probably even more inappropriate materials, as long as he has an internet connection and he doesn't have to pay for such access. It's not a federal secret that there's inappropriate material available on the internet. They had all Asif and City Field that announced that, right? There's plenty of inappropriate things that are available on the internet. So is it really a treyar b'dinara that you're causing them to violate an iser? So it's misayeya for someone who's anyway violating these averos. And furthermore, this really relates to what we discussed last week, right? Whether a goy, a non-Jew, has such isurim of tznius, right? Meaning we discussed that even though there is an isra rayos for a non-Jew, if there's a matter of abizrayu of arayos, or something that based on the Nachri's sensitivity, doesn't seem like a rayos for a Nachri. Like, this is obviously a far cry from Kol Isha, although that was the example we gave last week, right? So it could be that a Nachri doesn't have that same Isser, and that it's not Lifnei Iver to sell it to a Nachri. However, the other issue really to deal with is not so much whether it's permissible Mishum Lifnei Iver, but it's just Mechur Adavar to be dealing with such things. And the Chilul Hashem that could be involved, that it traces back, that that's who's selling, that they'll know that by the identification or the bank account that they're sending it to, or somehow, I'm sure these things can be done anonymously, but nothing's really ever totally anonymous, that there is a Jew involved in such a business of selling such things on eBay, Mechur Adavar Admiod. You certainly identify with the family's desire to just put it in a garbage bag, throw it out, and not even think about it ever again, and not to have to want to sell it. So the question is, are they permitted to sell it? Maybe, but certainly it would be inappropriate. If the question is, are they obligated to sell it because this fellow owed money? That's a more complicated question, right? To what extent do you have to pay back the debts of someone from your family who is no longer alive? So this too is a halacha mufreshes in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch in Simon Kuf Zayin in Chosh Mishpat Sif Aleph tells us that a Yoresh has to pay back the debts of his father, even if the father only left metaltalin, and metaltalin is not meshuba to a balchov, only karkas meshuba to a balchov. Even if the father only left metaltalin for the yerusha, the yoresh has to pay back the debts. And the sma explains the reason for that is, even though the balchov has no right to claim payment for money that you owe to him from the metaltalin of the deceased. However, there's a mitzvah for the Yorshim to pay back because of Kibud Ave'im. Kibud Ave'im. It's unbecoming for a person to have a reputation of someone who doesn't pay back his debts, even after he's deceased. So if the father didn't leave any money as an inheritance, the children are pater from paying back his debts, because the mitzvah of Kibud Ave'im, the halacha is, the Gemara is a whole sugi, Masechus Kiddushin, is it Mishal Av or Mishal Ben? And the halacha is that it's Mishal Av. It's got to come from the father's money, not from the kid's money. So if the father didn't leave them a Yerusha, they don't have to pay back. But the whole thing is all about a din of Kibud Ave'im. Over here, it's not Kibud Ave'im. The guy died without any children. It's his brother and his parents. They don't have a din of kibud to pay back his debts. Meikra din, they don't have to pay back his debts bichlal, right? If he left karka, so that would be meshubud to the balichov, and they should try to see to it that it gets paid to the balichov. But if he only left metaltalin, and all these items that he left are metaltalin, so they have no obligation to see to it that goes. That's not meshubud to a balichov, and the only obligation one would have to see to it that it gets paid back is Mishum Kibud Ave'im. The Nesivus on the spot tells us that even though the Shulchan Aruch does say that the Yorshim have a mitzvah to pay the loans back of the parents, the money that they've inherited belongs to them. It does not belong to the Balei Chov until they decide to pay it back. So if one of the Balei Chov would take it away from them, they could sue that person in Beis Din and say, no, it's not yours. Meaning, in Dine Mamanis, it really belongs to the Yorshim, because it's not Meshubah to the Balei Chov. In Dine dine mamanis, whatever metaltalin or money was left belongs to the Yarshim. And if a balchov comes in and is toface, so mafkinan minay. You can go to Beis Din and get the money back from him. It's just midine kibra ve'aim, you may have an obligation to pay it back if it's a parent that was deceased and that owed the money. So there was actually an interesting shaila I found that someone asked Rav Spitz, who wrote these beautiful svarim called Mishpatei HaTorah. So someone asked him the following. Oh, we're running out of time. I'll just tell you the shaila and you'll tell me what I think. The shaila was that a guy, I'll read you the shaila. Reuven studied in a Hebrew day school as a child. He went to a yeshiva as a kid. And he had a lot of financial difficulties. His parents owed tuition that they never paid back over the years. A while later, Reuven grew up, and his parents still owed $1,000. Reuven became educated and decided to go into teaching. He was hired as a teacher in the very school that he was educated in as a child. And when he was hired as a teacher, if everyone just mute themselves, I can't, for some reason, I don't have the ability to mute you. If he was hired as a teacher in that school, came time for his first paycheck, and his paycheck was missing a whole bunch of money. And he said to the school, "What's going on over here? I know teachers don't get paid well, but this is mamish nothing." So they told him, "Oh no, you owe us that money because your tuition. You owe us, so we're deducting it from your paycheck because you owe us that money from your tuition." So he said, "My parents owed you that money. I didn't owe you that money. What does that have to do with me?" So the shaila is the school permitted to keep the money? So Pashtus is no. You know, if Reuven's parents are no longer alive, or they're never going to be able to pay back, so it's nice of Reuven, he should, Mishum Kibra Avein, pay it back, but Midine Mamunis, they have no right to take that money away from him. Even if his parents left him money, and left him a Yerusha, if it's not Karka, and it's only Metaltalin, he's not obligated. Only Midin Kibra Avein would be obligated to pay it back. So Lechora, in that case, the school would be absolutely wrong, and Reuven would absolutely be allowed to keep the money. So bottom line, in our case, it seems that the brother is allowed to take the tools of the trade, and it seems that that the family is not obligated to go sell these items that they do not want to sell, and they can absolutely throw them in the garbage, despite the fact that they know that their deceased family member still owed a significant amount of money. Okay, everyone have a wonderful Shabbos, and stay tuned, I guess, to the WhatsApp group to determine when next year.
Rabbi touched upon a really important question, and I would appreciate if Rabbi helped formulate the question, involved with a lot of the yeshivas. So, you know, question of giving tuition assistance, mm-hmm. and should tuition assistance be a loan, or should it, you know, be a forgiveness? But it just hit me, as you were describing the case, when people send money to yeshiva, they get a tax deduction. They count it as Meiser, and they get a tax deduction for it. Why should the yeshiva then go to the recipient of that chesed and say, "Well, now, you know what, we're going to give you a tuition assistance, but it's going to be a loan," when the budget of every money raised is either Meiser money or money deducted for tax purposes with the IRS? Does that make any sense?
I hear what you're asking. It's a good. I hear what you're saying. Meaning, if someone is giving a donation, so then why should someone else have to pay back that donation? Right? Is that right?
Right. Unless it's the gemach, and if it's not a gemach.
So I think I think the way the way they view it is that they're two separate transactions. That someone's giving a donation that allows us to educate these children for now. But at the same time, a separate transaction, the parents are expected to, if they're ever able to, I think all of these contracts, they don't say that they're absolutely obligated, but if they're able to, that they should.
Big discussions in the room sometimes is, you know, we'll give it as a loan. And this is one of the most recent.
The mamish as a loan, not even like if you're able to pay back. That's very hard. That's very hard for people.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the discussion. I just want, you know. It just dawned on me, this is a very good argument. I don't know if it's a good argument, because the way you formulated it, sort of like twisted. I'm giving money for the continuity of the school, and the school then has, you know, the ability to do what it wants with it.
Right.
But I'd
be very hesitant about a loan in these cases, because those who require tuition assistance, in my experience, do not require tuition assistance for a year or two. It's for many, many years, one on top of the other. It's going to be many, many, many thousands of dollars. And obviously there's a reason they needed the tuition assistance in the first place. The chances that they can take upon themselves that amount of debt as an actual loan. I mean, it's one thing to say, look, if your mazel ever changes and you make a major investment and you become wealthy, so you should pay it back, or to pay back slowly to make us a priority in your tzedakah. But to make it like a mamish loan, I don't know. Do schools, you know, I'm a little out of the loop.
It's part of the conversation, because when you go into the room and you say, well, okay, this person lives in a house that's worth, you know, $800,000, $1.5 million. Okay, the income is, you know, X, but they decide to live on. I'm personally uncomfortable, because, you know, where I grew up and, you know, the fact that I was able to go to yeshiva as a kid, and my parents were refused from yeshiva in the Bronx, which was the more firm yeshiva, and my brother was kicked out because they couldn't pay tuition, you know, the survivors, no family, you know, I wound up going to Salanta, which Rabbi Sabbath in Shemayim, you should have a special place. He told my parents, don't worry about it, just, you know, bring your, you know, my brother, just bring your son in the next day, and they said, we'll figure it out, and that was it, that's all he said.
Look, Hi Arbisfeld, right? What did we just talk about at the Reitz dinner? Hi Arbisfeld. 11 years of free tuition, and it made YU $12 million off of that. I think they told the story incorrectly, because I remember Hi telling me, our last conversation before he was Nifter, he was telling me all about his father and the Mesiras Nefesh and everything else, and he said that he decided he wanted to give $11 million to YU, because $1 million for each year that he was on campus for free. And then he said, so he had given $9 million to date, he told me. And then he realized that there's an opportunity to dedicate a chair for $3 million. And he said, but that would put me at 12. I only said I wanted to give 11. And then he said to himself, why should there be a limit on Hakaras HaTov? I should set a limit for only 11 million? Mehechi Taisi. If you have Hakaras HaTov, there should be no limit. So he did $3 million so that it could be a $12 million. Right? That's the story. They didn't tell that at the dinner.
That's the story. That is the story.
Mom is amazing. What an inspiring person.
I met Hai. It's so funny. When I met him, so I didn't know what to call him, Mr. Arbisfeld, whatever. It's like 8, 9.
I heard you became Mr. Orlinsky at the board meetings.
So he said, call me I, you know. So he called me up, you know, with a raspy voice. And like, you know, he'd call me up and I'd go, Hi. and he was just amazing. I mean, he, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I had such a bond with him. You know, to have him call you, you know, and give you a call and just, like, you know, want to talk to you, to me it was like cloud nine. He was the best. He was really, yeah. But yes, it was $9 million at the time.
Yeah.
When I heard the story from him.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't hear the last part because.
Right. It was at the very end.
It was like a year and a half, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's what he told me, I remember. And he told me he has a lot more to tell me. And old Chazon Lamoe, there will be opportunities. Unfortunately, there never were. But,
yeah.
I got to run to Mincha, so I'm going to say good Shabbos to everybody.
And we have a beautiful Shabbos, brother.
Thank you. Good Shabbos.
Yeah.